Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jeff, and welcome back to another episode of Lean In with Jeff. Today, we have an exciting movie review lined up, so please be excited for that. It seems like the sun is coming out soon, which is great because the first day of the 2025 graduation is tomorrow. It said it was going to rain 60%, I think, but let's just hope that it's nice and sunny out. So yeah, I guess we can all wish that the weather's going to get a little warmer. We'll get through some ads, some PSAs, and some show promos, and we'll get right into the episode. So I'll see you guys in a couple minutes.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra Siam, Nisiam, Nisiaya,
Anthasiakuya, Talitin, Homasque Mustao. Crafting with the Scouts is not only fun, but helps me build problem solving skills. This role allows me to bring my creativity, my ideas to life, and every project is an opportunity for me to learn something new.
Take our online quiz and find your perfect volunteer role. Adventure awaits. Join us at scouts.ca/volunteer.
Is the simple joy of riding a bike missing from your life? No worries. Ride On Bike Shop has got you covered. Ride On has the best deals in town for new and used bikes, top-notch servicing, and all the parts or accessories you've been dreaming about. Whether you've got a little one who needs to learn how to ride, or if you're about to go on the Tour de France, Ride On is the place for you. We'll also happily pick up your old bikes and recycle them back into the community. Located on 2255 West Broadway, we are open from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. from Tuesday to Saturday. That's R-I-D-E-O-N Bike Shop. See you there!
You are invited to volunteer for Swissessism Garden. Get away from the rat race. Get back to the land. Heal. Reconnect with yourself. Touch grass. Find a quiet place among the plants and find a quiet place inside yourself. Check us out on Facebook at Indigenous Garden UBC Farm, or visit the Swissessism Indigenous Garden located at UBC Farm just off of Ross Road.
Hey, what's that song from that movie?
Every other Wednesday at 6 p.m., join me, Logan the Extra.
And me, Movie Maverick Mike, as we discuss popular songs featured in movies, or popular movies that feature songs.
On That Song from That Movie, we talk about how the song fits into the movie, why they chose the song they did.
And we'll share our expert opinions on the art of music and movies.
So if you find yourself asking, I wonder what that song from that movie is, check us out every other Wednesday at 6 to 6:30 p.m.
Or you can listen to all our episodes on CITR.ca. Who knows, maybe we talked about that song or movie that you love.
We are That Song from That Movie every second Wednesday at 6 p.m. or anytime at citr.ca.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jeff, and welcome back to another episode of Leanin' with Jeff. I'm really excited to review this movie, so why don't we get right into it? But today we have a very special guest. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, everyone on the CITR airwaves. My name is Georgia Guthrie. I am actually, well, I'm no stranger to CITR. I am one of the co-hosts and co-producers of Film Picnic, which is on air every other Friday at 10 a.m. Quick plug.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Georgia, for coming on.
Thank you for having
me. Well, first of all, I want to ask, so you did say that you wrote a paper on this movie. So do you want to kind of give a quick rundown on what this movie is about and what kind of intrigued you initially?
Oh, my God. Okay. Did you already say what we're talking about today? Or is this me announcing it?
You are announcing it.
Okay. Wait. No, sorry. I was going to try and be dramatic, but I don't know if I can
drum
do that.
Roll.
Brokeback Mountain. Directed by Ang Lee.
Yes.
I'd seen this film a few times before. And then this past term at UBC, I'm in film studies as my major, and I was in a melodrama class, and this film was programmed as part of the syllabus. Shout out that class. It's a great class if you're at UBC and you're in film studies. I highly recommend. But yeah, it was programmed as part of the class, which is also crazy because I watched it at like 9 a.m. on a Monday, and I just had to go about the rest of my day after watching this film. And for those of you who haven't seen it, it'll just wreck you. It's emotionally impactful, certainly. I'm just trying to think, like, synopsis. It stars Jake Gyllenhaal and Heath Ledger as cowboys, or kind of like ranch hands, who are herding sheep on Brokeback Mountain, which is the kind of mountainscape that the film is, you know, the majority of the film is set in. And that is also, as I'll talk about later, is, you know, really significant to have this, like, very beautiful, very rugged outdoors space. And then there is a element of very dear element of love. And there's a really intense kind of relationship that develops between these two cowboys and these two characters, battling kind of with internalized homophobia as a condition of the times in which they live. I believe it's set, oh, God.
The initial date was 1963.
Yeah, okay.
And then it kind of just goes from there.
Yeah, it jumps a little bit in time. Like, by the end of the movie, they're
Which I
they're
really
older.
Loved, by the way.
Yeah, you know what? And I will say, sometimes when films do that, you're like, oh, that's not a convincing aged character. But I thought they aged Jake Gyllenhaal very nicely. I was like, you know what? He looks old. He looks older
with the
than
mustache.
He was. Yeah, like a little bit of gray, you know, because sometimes it just feels very unconvincing. And I don't know. That was an element of realism that I really appreciated. But yeah, I don't know. I wrote this. Wow, this is just me.
No, please go on. Yeah.
I don't know. What really struck me about this, I think, as a person with, you know, queer identity myself, like I feel so privileged to exist in a time when it feels, in a time and a space when it feels safe to be queer. And this movie kind of explores, again, it's a very privileged kind of like white male homosexuality, but still, like, you know, a different experience of what it means to be queer, and just in a different time when it was socially unacceptable, and still, you know, like maintaining the really raw and really real fact that there is a love between these two people, and kind of portraying it in its most natural form. And just as like, as a love story between two people. And I don't know. I was initially, I think, drawn to it as a subject to write about because I identified with like the queer element. And then also, I don't know, like the cowboy of it all is really compelling, and I enjoy that. But yeah, essentially, like, what my paper was about is kind of diving into this, like, queer love as an act of resistance. And, you know, we can even dive in later, too, like, about the reception of the film, kind of, goodness, I should know the year it came out. 2005.
Yeah.
2005.
Yeah, the 2000s.
Great. Obviously, I really know my stuff.
No.
But yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe you know of this film and you just know of it as the gay cowboy movie, which was kind of like the reception at the time it came out too. Like, even though the fact that it is a really beautiful and really emotionally wrought and raw and real and complex film about a complex relationship between two people, it's still kind of, its cultural reception was like kind of a joke because it is about this homosexual love story and, like, you know, like, people making jokes about, like,
yeah,
the scenes of intimacy, which are, like, very robust and very present in the film. And still it was kind of taken as, like, oh, like, haha, like, gay cowboy shit. Like, you know, people not taking it. I don't know. I'm just, like, in my mind, I'm, like, the people that are making those jokes, have you really seen the film? Because I don't know. I feel like this is the kind of movie that even if you're homophobic, you watch it and then maybe it garners some sort of sympathy, or even if it doesn't make you completely shift your views, it, you know, like pulls the empathy string, just because of the really intense emotional work that it kind of does. Wow, I've been talking for a long time.
No, I actually really want to add on your point there is that, you know, hopefully, you know, people who are homophobic can, I think the film really just gets you to open your eyes on the internalized struggles that these men go through. And, you know, we always hear discourse about people who experience these struggles and being depressed internally, not being able to express them. But to see it in the film and the way that they shot it, I think it's a really beautiful way to show and educate people on what, you know, they actually go through. And I think this ties back to the concept of trauma as well, because we're kind of going to go into Heath Ledger's character. Well, Ennis Delmar. Mm-hmm. I really love the name, you know, Jack Twist. Ennis Delmar.
Yeah. No, the twist really, I feel like that must be intentional. Or I don't know. I'm like, mm-hmm. Ooh. You're subverting the norm. You're twisting the norm. I don't know. Whatever.
Oh, that's
maybe it's
good.
Just a name.
That's a good explanation. There definitely was a twist at the end. But before we actually get into the movie, this is, like Georgia mentioned, it is a very emotionally heavy movie. Mm. And so maybe having that in mind before you watch it is a great kind of thing to have. But yeah, I mean, Ennis, the society that they live in, they are not very accepting with the concept of homosexuality. But at the same time, we get to know that Ennis's father, I mean, both fathers, Ennis and Jack, their fathers are very, very homophobic. And Ennis experienced this really tragic event where he had to see a deceased man who allegedly was a gay man, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was, you know, dragged around very violently and he actually died in some rural area that he had to see as a young kid. And so that kind of sparked a very, very, very big trauma for him. And that actually led him to be very hesitant and in denial with his sexuality. But I also want to talk about the word beautiful. I think it's beautiful in the way that, you know, the concept of the movie and the way that it was shown and the intentions of it. But I first was watching the movie on my phone, and I had to switch it to my laptop.
Jeff, that's criminal.
I know.
Can we just say that's,
yeah.
You know what? I'll say my rule, TV on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
TV is acceptable on the phone. Movies on the phone.
No, I agree.
It's dire and it's upsetting.
No, in particular, this was such a beautiful film, and it was shot so, like, the landscape was just so beautiful. And
yeah.
I think there was just moments where I just forgot about the movie, and I was just so busy just looking at, like, the shots and the nature, and I'm like,
the cinematography is certainly,
oh my god, yeah, it was very good.
Impactful. I will say, like, one of the points I made in my paper was, like, because it's set in this natural landscape, and there's very, like, at a time when homosexuality was kind of associated with these lowbrow, like, sleazy motel or truck stop run-ins, like, we're getting an authentic story about love between two people, and set in this very naturalistic setting. I mean, there is like one, there is one motel in the film, but like, you know, the vast majority of it is on these beautiful green rolling hills, and you know, like the white cliffs and the mountain, and you know, streams and rocks, and it's like, you know, they're camping and they're outside, and it's all very natural. And I think kind of that exterior naturalist landscape that they're existing within helps portray the relationship between them as natural and normal, as opposed to something that is, you know, more like, it's providing a different kind of connotation for the relationship and contextualizing the relationship in a different way versus if we were only seeing, you know, like, or, you know, other media at the time, like portraying queer relationships, like, again, you know, in like gay bars or strip joints or like, yeah, the kind of sleazy motel truck stop places. And I really appreciate that about it. Like, the landscape is natural. The love between them is natural. And yeah, I don't know. It's a beautiful parallel.
No, I totally agree. I think the idea of homosexuality in other movies, at least the ones that I've watched throughout the years, it definitely has this stereotypical way that it is shot and it is shown. Mm. And I think it was very refreshing to see such a beautiful landscape be included into this plot line, actually. I want to get into the characters to begin with. Mm. In my opinion, I think Jack Twist is quite open-minded. We can kind of see who he is as a person quite early on as well. But Ennis is very internalized with his character and who he is. We can also see that Jack, there was a moment in the scene where I think Ennis was sharing his story about his family background. And Jack was like, "That's the most I've heard you say anything."
Yeah.
You know, all the time that we were here. And he's like, "That's the most I've ever spoken, you know, ever." Mm-hmm. And we can kind of see that he's just kind of living a life that society, living a life that's, you know, socially acceptable. Because we can see that Ennis has a wife. He's planning to marry later on. Mm-hmm. And so it seems like he has everything in order. But at the same time, we don't really see much of him and himself just expressing who he is. Mm. And so my question to you is, do you think that Ennis was aware of his sexuality before he began herding the sheep? Because this is very young. He was 18?
Yeah.
Something along the line. He was very young, like 20-ish, when he first met Jack, and then he began herding the sheep, and that was kind of the summer that really changed himself. But I don't even know if it was changed, but do you think he was aware of who he was? You know, possibly even the day that he saw the deceased man with his father, or was that like a trigger? What do you think the history behind Ennis's character was like, and how did you interpret it?
I mean, like, obviously, it's hard to know. It's hard to know maybe how Ennis was feeling before he, or, you know, he had these. The information that was given to him was clear, you know, from his family and his upbringing, and those kinds of the lines of what was right and what was wrong were established. But then, you know, I think, like, kind of going back to the environment, as it's a place of freedom where they can, you know, they're alone in these mountains together. They're exploring each other freely, but it's also a place of isolation. They're alone for vast, like, I mean, alone with sheep, but with no other human comforts for extended periods of time besides one another. And so I think, you know, that isolation is part of what drives them together, you know, which obviously, like, good that it happened because they got to be with each other. I mean, yeah, I don't know. Like, I don't know if I would have, if I had been trapped in a space alone with another person after so long, and then you're like, you have base desires that you need satisfied, but then also, like, you know, if you're able to open up emotionally with someone and you feel safe with them in a way that Ennis starts to feel safe with Jack, and that comfortability kind of builds over time. I think, I don't know, when it comes to their characters, like, the beginning of how they start to feel that way is what is less impactful for me, and more, it's more about the way that they survive and the different strategies with which they navigate their queerness in the world. Because you do, like, between Ennis and Jack, there are two really kind of contrasting approaches. And I will say, yeah, for those who haven't seen the film, they're meeting up in the mountains as the time goes on and, like, go on these, like, quote-unquote fishing trips together.
Yeah.
But they both end up marrying women, and they both end up having children. So it's very much they're both kind of living another life in the mountains of Brokeback, again, like, the mountains as a place of freedom. But yeah, when it comes to characters, like, Jack has aspirations and persistence kind of over time, suggesting that, oh, like, we should go buy a piece of land and we could just work it together. And Jack is very hopeful about a future with Ennis, whereas Ennis is kind of surviving through repression and caution. He's, like, choosing this isolation over overexposure, which I think maybe is a result of what he saw as a child, you know, and this internalized homophobia, like, from witnessing that violence. He's prioritizing safety, and he's like, I need to stay safe. He's less willing to even hope for a future with Jack because he has seen what the consequences are and knows what the consequences are. And I also think that kind of manifests in the way that they even just carry themselves. Like, Jack is more outgoing and outspoken, and, you know, he lands Anne Hathaway's beautiful character because he's, you know, kind of charming. And Ennis is very much, like, communicates through his body language instead of the way that he speaks, and, like, it's all grunts and, like, yeah. You know, even, like, another thing I was really paying attention to, also, thank you for letting me just, like, ramble on all my different thoughts.
Please go ahead.
But
yeah.
I love the kind of subtle clues that we as an audience get from whether or not we can see Ennis's eyes. Like, there's a moment when, after, I guess, spoilers also, whatever.
No, this is supposed to be spoilers. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, like, after Ennis has gotten divorced and he's dated this woman and then he's since broken up with this woman, he's sitting in a cafe alone, again, like, a result of this isolation that he's constantly pushing on himself. And we can't even see his eyes under the brim of his hat. Mm-hmm. Like, he's hiding always.
Yeah.
And then the girlfriend comes in and is like, you know, he barely even looks at her. He barely even speaks to her. Whereas Jack, we can see his eyes always.
Yeah.
And I mean, also Jake Gyllenhaal, like, big, beautiful blue eyes. Mm-hmm. yeah, I don't know. The character contrast between them is so important, again, like, in the way that they carry themselves and their queerness. And I think it says a lot about, I mean, and also, like, I think it makes the relationship between them more compelling, which is not specific to this movie, but, like, obviously, you know, opposites attract, or, like, it's, I mean, obviously it's more engaging to, like, watch a film where the characters are different and that creates conflict and, you know, creates a more interesting story than if they were both. I mean, but also, you know what, I will say, like, it wouldn't have made for as good of a film, but I would have 100% watched a film where Jack Twist and Ennis Del Mar just decide to buy a piece of land together and live happily ever after. I would have watched it. I would have loved
too.
It.
Because I wasn't quite aware of what this movie was going in terms of the direction emotionally, I kind of assumed that it would work that way. And also because of how much Jack would mention it, I just assumed, like, okay, he's making so many attempts. Why wouldn't Ennis take up on it? He got divorced. Mm. And so I thought that was kind of a great segue to move on. Mm. But it didn't work out, and I think that was the really sad part. And also, when you said the hat, so he doesn't quite look at his ex-girlfriend. Was that the one in the cafe where it was eating a pie? And mm-hmm. Okay, so
a very lonesome cup of black coffee.
Yeah, the pie looked delicious, though.
Yeah.
So there was a line that she said. I forgot her name, but she said, "Women don't fall in love with fun."
Yeah,
and I don't know why that stuck with me so much. And I think that kind of shows that it's almost like Ennis feels like he deserves love with Jack, but when he's with other people, it's like he doesn't. It's like he almost has to provide them with some sort of service or provide them with like some sort of persona to for him to feel that he can be loved or valued. And so he kind of just brushes it off. And I just thought it was so sad that he has, not only does he have this idea of what's acceptable as a man, but just as a person. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, that line kind of stuck with me a lot. And this kind of goes into the woman that he has a relationship with, starting with Alma.
Mm.
And
Alma's Ennis's wife.
Well, his wife,
yeah.
Who he divorces. He has two beautiful daughters with. It was very confusing to me because I don't want to antagonize Alma, but at the same time, I couldn't quite understand. Because in my mind, somebody who's a spouse and who loves their spouse, you know, aside from doing like a really horrible crime, okay, yeah, I guess that would be understandable. But at the same time, she did see him, you know, having an affair, you know, in the parking lot when she saw them kissing. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's a very big shock. But I don't quite understand why it took her so long. She still hasn't confronted Ennis about it, by the way. Like in the kitchen scene when Ennis was helping her doing the dishes, that was not a confrontation at all. Like she didn't get her point across. She wasn't communicating in any way that was explicit. It was just pure anger and like frustration, and I just didn't know why she would treat Ennis like that. Do you think that has anything to do with because of how homosexuality was viewed in that time, or was it, you know, it could have been just a mixture of him not being honest, or, you know, possibly irresponsible for the fact that he has a family? What did you think about Alma's character in general?
I mean, as much as it's a film about you know, about these two male characters and like obviously a lot about masculinity and what masculinity means, I think examining the women in this film is also really interesting.
Yeah.
Because like, I mean, my first instinct when I think about Alma is just like her unbridled strength is what is impressive and immediately stands out to me about her. The fact that, and you know, like I think, and the film paints this well too, like there is a semblance of love and pleasure and romance in the beginning of Alma and Ennis's relationship, and it is kind of innocent and fun, and there's a sledding like montage, yeah. And you know, like
very romantic.
He's romancing her, and even if it's not in the same way that he loves Jack, like there is some sort of genuine foundation on which their relationship is built. And then over time, that is, you know, like fades a little bit. And then you see the pressures of just domestic life and like Ennis, you know, again, like the things that he's repressing are manifesting in other ways because he can't be with Jack and he can't, you know, be with the people that he wants to love. Like it's comes out as aggression towards Alma and, you know, even like you can see a little bit of like resentment for the life and the things that they do together. Like they don't go out often. Alma wants to go to some social function with a church, yeah. And you know, he's very like, you can just tell that
just drinking beer,
just smoking, coping, yeah, with like the existence that he is stuck in. And again, doesn't feel hope about in the same way that Jack does. And again, like also, yeah, Alma again, like kind of telling of the time that it is made, or not made, but set.
Yeah.
Alma is the wife, so she's doing all this housework. They're also poor, and she's, you know, like working a job at the grocery store, and then like is constantly the one taking care of the kids. And like, she kind of just assumes this role of taking care of all of like the things that Ennis doesn't want to deal with, or like, you know, she is the support and the foundation on which Ennis's very small budding hope about Jack is able to, like, you know, he's only able to go on these fishing trips because Alma is there with the kids, yeah, and with the girls. And I don't know, like her character is so interesting to me also because, you know, she puts up with it. And then you can kind of see, like, after discovering the fact that they're, like, after witnessing them kissing outside when Jack is coming to visit Ennis for the first time, like, she's calculating in her head, like, you know, oh my God, like, we're gonna have to, like, I just feel like you can see so many things happening in her mind at that moment and kind of contemplating what this means and how does she survive without a husband and, like, you know, what does getting divorced mean? And, like, it's, I mean, kind of in the Ennis style, it's easier to just ignore. It's easier to just put away and compartmentalize and, like, brush the tears away. And I don't know. I will say when they finally get divorced and Alma is with, I think it's, like, her manager from the grocery yeah. store or something, like, I felt, I'm happy for her in those instances, you know, and I'm like, look at you, like, a woman taking agency and not, like, accepting this man who's kind of ignoring you anymore and, like, you know, who doesn't want to, I don't know, kind of, like, take ownership of his kids in his life because he's yearning after something that he is also vehemently denying himself. Like, I don't know, in those moments, I think Alma is a hero for herself. And I'm like, yeah, strong woman, amazing. And then, yeah, I don't know, like, I think we kind of see that. I wish, what's the name of the girlfriend that Ennis has later? I don't even know.
Yeah, I forgot.
Awkward. Well.
I'm going to be real. I don't really, I appreciate the fact that she seemed to love Ennis, but the scene when she just takes Ennis to dance when it was her and Ennis brought his daughter. I don't know. She just seems, I don't think I would have appreciated that if I was there. I would have wanted her to talk to me more instead of just take my dad and go dancing and, like, what am I doing in this bar? You know? Like, I don't know. It was just...
I mean, I think the girlfriend's a victim of circumstance. Yeah. You know? Like it's a messy moment yeah, that they're in. Yeah. Like, there's a daughter here. He's trying to bond with her. There's a girlfriend that clearly wants a larger role in Ennis's life that he doesn't really care to give her because he doesn't... He knows who he wants to be with, and he can't be with him, so everything else is kind of like, bleh. Wow, that was super articulate.
No. Do you think, though, right, if you remember this scene, Alma was sitting in the kitchen. I think she was either smoking or something, and Ennis was getting ready for the next magical fishing trip. Mm. And then right as soon as he was about to leave, she says, "Are you forgetting something?" And when she said that, I assumed, like, a kiss from Ennis, but then he just takes the equipment on the table. But when I saw that scene, I began to imagine, do you think that if Ennis was honest about his desires for Jack and his sexuality and what he's... Because I don't even think he probably hasn't ever shared that experience that he had with his dad, with Alma, with nobody but Jack. Mm. And so it's almost like Jack holds his deepest secret and in many ways. But do you think that Alma as a character, from what we see, would have been accepting or would have been willing to go on with the conversation if he were to mention it? Or do you think it was better for him to just push everybody away? I mean, definitely that wasn't a good choice. But at the same time, I can't really imagine any other alternatives that could have been taking place.
Do you mean, like, would Alma have been receptive to talking yeah. about that kind of past trauma? Yeah.
Well, like, would there have been a conversation there with some decency and respect?
I don't know. Because when
Alma ends up marrying the manager of the store, I also felt very happy for her. I think she finally deserved the loving husband that she definitely deserves because, you know, she is the backbone of the entire family. She's working. You know, Ennis is very careless. He goes on alleged fishing trips. And so I was very surprised with how understanding Alma was as a person and very accepting with Ennis and his and whatever he was doing, even after, you know, witnessing what she witnessed in that parking lot. But I feel like she wasn't fully happy with her new husband. And I think I don't know if I just saw that at the dinner table on Thanksgiving. And I think it's because I thought that Alma wanted Ennis to open up to her about what was going on. And she was waiting and waiting. And although she was furious of the fact that this was an affair and, you know, whatever thoughts that she had about sexuality at that time, I think as someone who she deeply loved and created a family with, she was almost waiting for him to say something, but he just never did. And so that, you know, angry conclusion of that whole explosion in the kitchen while washing dishes was kind of the aftermath of everybody suppressing everything and finally opening up in the worst way possible.
Yeah, I mean, I think also, like, one of the things that the film technically is doing really interesting is, like, kind of every moment of liberation or freedom or expression is punctuated with some kind of punishment.
Yeah.
Like, you know, as we're talking about this thing in the kitchen, this big explosion, like, you know, like finally acknowledging the truth about himself, you know, I mean, it's in a very confrontation kind of way, but like almost like you don't go up there to fish.
Yeah.
Kind of admitting, you know, creating the tension and like a turning point in the film, where he's been outed, in a way, and then immediately the scene after is him like getting punched out by a guy in a truck.
Yeah.
Like, or, you know, even like the first time Jack and Ennis at the beginning of the movie are like up in the mountains together and they kiss and then they're intimate, like the immediate next scene is that a sheep has been killed, and it's like almost seems like kind of a punishment for this moment of freedom and liberation that they've had. So like, yeah, in a way I'm kind of like with this film, because it is so male-centric, I almost feel like, on the one hand, I'm like, ah, yes, like, Alma taking control of her life and going to be with the grocery store owner. I mean, personally, like, I think it's interesting you say that you don't know that she was, like, happy with her new husband, because I'm kind of like, I don't even know if we get that deep into her character. Mm-hmm. Like, because, I mean, the women in the film, they're not painted as antagonists. They're just kind of witnesses.
Yeah.
They don't have a lot of agency, I would say, besides Alma, like, deciding that she's going to go create this new life for herself. Like, they're not depicted in any naturalistic environments. They're always in the home, or, you know, in these, like, more domestic settings and with the kids or, you know, those kinds of... They're not, like... They're financially dependent on the men, again, like, condition of the time. Yeah, they're not... I mean, I guess I appreciate that they're not obstacles. They're not villains. They're kind of, like, victims to the circumstance. I don't know. What I explore a little bit in my paper is kind of the fact that, like, there's, you know, there's, like, the women are... And specifically, Alma is kind of a way to prove, like, the impacts of what being in the closet can do, not just to a person, the person that is in the closet, but also their families and, like, the collateral damage that can kind of happen. And, like, living this life of secrecy and, like, you know, just, like, she suffered in her marriage for years and, like... I don't know. It's all, I mean, her performance also too is like, it's very silent and it's very brooding and it's like suppressed knowledge. And it's all, like you said, like that moment with, oh, you're forgetting something. It's like all very muted expressions. And yeah, I think it fits very well with Ennis's general disposition, which is also similar, and kind of a lot of things are left unsaid. I would love to know your take on Jack's wife. Lorraine?
Yeah.
I think that's her name, maybe. I should know.
I think so. Lorraine.
Lorraine Newsome? Like something, yeah. Newsome. Yeah. I think it starts with an L.
Sure.
Because, I don't know, like, I feel like there's a little bit more spice. There's a little bit more verve in Jack and Lorraine's relationship and the way that they interact versus, well, actually, I would love to know your take on maybe, like, the masculinity roles within that relationship. Because you have
Jack, is a who's
like
question.
Because he, you know, like a closeted person, but then, you know, there's Lorraine's father is just like a bitchy in-law who does not like him. There's some classism at work. There's some sexism at work.
For sure.
I don't know. What's your take?
Yeah, no. Thank you for asking this question. I'd love to go into Laurie. You know what? Let me just get Anne Hathaway's character. So
let's do a quick Google search for the quality of the episode.
So Anne Hathaway, Laurene, Newsome twist.
Right.
Okay. I guess that makes sense. To begin with, Laurene comes from a very wealthy family. Mm. Her dad owns a very nice equipment business. So he sells equipment or something.
Yeah. Like farming equipment.
Yeah, yeah. Trucking equipment and stuff. And so she ends up working for her father later. We can clearly see that Jack is very underappreciated in the family. When Laurene gives birth, grandpa comes in and says, "Doesn't he look just like grandpa?" Mm. And I'm like, "Wow, you." And so, Jack is very underappreciated. It's very interesting because from the movie, the society has this very fixed role of masculinity, a man, being the leader, going to work, making money, being attracted to a woman, having a wife and family. And that's
which kind of leans into the Western trope as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so to see Jack create his own family and that role for me, it was reversed. It was almost Laurene was the one who was centralized and was kind of the one almost leading the family. And Jack was kind of the one tagging along.
Wearing the pants.
Yeah. And that was kind of how he was being treated as well. It's like Jack had no value, but the fact that he contributed to giving birth to this wonderful young boy. And so I think that was a very interesting contrast with almost challenging the male role in the movie.
Mm.
And Laurene's character, I don't think she had anything to do with, demonizing Jack as a character. I mean, she's married to him. It seems like she's appreciating him. And I think the caring, loving emotions that she has for Jack shows when she says, why doesn't Ennis ever come up here? Why is it that you're going all the way down there driving? I was also surprised. How long did he like? It was a very long drive.
Yeah.
Like 15 hours or something like that.
I think, one of them is in Wyoming and the other one's in
Texas.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow. And I'm like, yeah, that is a long drive. But we can kind of see, the questions that Laurene begins to ask, like, why is it that you never bring him up for anything? I never get to see him. Mm. All you do is talk about him. What is going on? And so it seems like Laurene wants to get to know who this mysterious Ennis is, and she kind of cares for him. She wants to get to know it, but at the same time, Jack is also being very closeted in terms of what he shares with.
Yeah. He's withholding.
Oh, yeah, withholding, yeah.
I mean, I think, honestly, kind of like the ambiguity of how much Laurene knows, I think is one of the most, compelling uncertainties of the film. Because it doesn't, even in this final, spoiler alert, guys, even in this final phone call that Laurene and Ennis share after Jack has been killed, Ennis finds out that Jack is no longer alive and then calls his wife. And on the phone, the way that she's speaking with him and talking about, what she's saying into the phone is, kind of voiceover put with, actual footage of what has happened to Jack. So she's telling this story about, I think he's, gets hit in the head after, a tire, a road accident. A tire or something, bursts. And she's saying it was an accident. And then what we're really seeing is footage of what actually happened, which is that he was targeted in a hate crime by a bunch of homophobic people who assault him. But in this kind of phone conversation with Ennis, she's emulating, I think, kind of the same energy that she, even though there was this initial spark with Jack, they meet at a rodeo and she drops her hat and she's this beautiful horse rider. And clearly there's a passion in the beginning. And then over the course of time, it devolves into this business-like marriage, and he's in the family business, and but she's kind of running things, kind of wearing the pants, and then her dad, his in-law, his stepfather is not stepfather, father-in-law, is clearly kind of the real man in their house, and it becomes very transactional, and I think that kind of comes through on the phone with Ennis, you know, it's very cold. It's very like, oh, this is what happened. There's no emotion in her voice. Like,
yeah, I question that. Why that was.
I mean, I feel like it's, you know, it's offering, Ang Lee is offering us two options that, you know, it's unclear maybe which one it is. Like, either she's knowingly complicit in concealing Jack's true identity of who he is, or it's genuine ignorance and this is just some random friend calling and she's just telling the lie. I don't know. I mean, I guess it's kind of, I wonder, like, does her character know what has actually happened to Jack? The stone cold expression on her face tells me yes. But then again, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I question why she was so cold and so emotionless. I also wonder if that was actually the way that Jack died, because from what I got, again, it's very ambiguous. I don't really know if Jack was a victim of a hate crime or if that tire accident was real, but you know, it seemed very hard to believe. But what I got was the imaginative death that Ennis gets a flashback, not a flashback, but he imagines, is maybe that's kind of how he wants to believe what happened. Because that would kind of reinforce and give himself another reason for why, yeah, this is why we didn't pursue it. Like, this is why our love wouldn't have worked, because one of us, maybe both of us, would have died.
Yeah.
And so maybe, and also that whole imaginative scene is, I think, once again, drawn from the trauma that he saw when he was a young kid.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's almost like, you know, she says it was a tire blown out, but maybe in his mind, because Ennis doesn't know whether Laureen knows about Jack being gay.
Yeah.
And I think
they're not on FaceTime.
Yeah.
He's in a phone booth.
Yeah, for sure.
Not that even if they were on FaceTime, she's giving no clues with her face anyways.
Oh, yeah. No, she's. And so I think during the phone call, Ennis, in his mind, is like, yeah, she doesn't know. I don't think she knows what really could have happened.
Mm.
And so that's kind of the imagination that he goes through, and possibly what he wants to believe, because if it was truly an accident, I don't know how he would survive with the guilt of just, why didn't I give it a chance? You know, if I gave it a chance, maybe would have been, you know, something that could have happened.
Mm.
But I don't know. Maybe that was just a way of him coping again, you know, trying to imagine this tragic event of, you know, being a victim of a hate crime is something that he wishes would have happened instead of just a dumb accident, you know, of getting hit by this tire rim or something. You know?
Jeff, you're so imaginative. I would have never thought that.
Yeah, that's kind of what I thought. And I hope it wasn't a hate crime, but at the same time, I don't know. I think Ennis is a very strong character as well. I don't know if anybody could endure that many decades worth of just pure heartbreak.
Mm.
And this actually brings me to the last scene. Again, very ambiguous. He says, "I swear," as he
Jack,
looks.
"I swear."
Yeah, I swear. I love the accent, by the way.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. And so he says, "I swear," as he looks at the clothing and the picture. I believe that was a postcard that he.
It's a postcard of Brokeback.
Yeah.
And so this is context for listeners. This is Ennis going to visit Jack's parents after Jack has passed away. Ennis kind of grieving, you know, looking for some sort of closure, going to Jack's parents' house and saying like, oh, I knew him, I liked him, he was a good guy, whatever. And then he gets to go, and then you kind of get the hint that like maybe the mom knows that there's some kind of deeper relationship between the two of them, and she's like, oh, do you want to go upstairs into Jack's old room? And he discovers the shirts that are in the closet, like kind of hidden, literally in the closet.
Yeah.
Hidden in the closet is Jack's shirt and Ennis's shirts that they had originally worn up on Brokeback, and like gotten into this like fight with one another, like a physical fight, and they were bloody and like there's blood on the shirt still, so that's how you can tell that that's what they are. And they're like kind of folded into one another, like they're both on one hanger and one shirt is inside the other. And then as he's like Ennis takes those shirts when he leaves, and it's such an emotional scene when he's like discovering that Jack has kept the shirts all along, and like he thinks about Brokeback in those early days in the mountains. And oh my God, you guys, I was just like, when I was watching this, I was crying so hard. But then, yeah, when the final scene in the movie, when Ennis is like, Jack, I swear, that's when he's back in he's lonesome. He's on his own. Like, the performance of heteronormativity has failed with his wife, with his girlfriend. He's kind of alone with himself and the reality of who he is in a trailer by himself. His daughter has just visited and then left. And he has the shirts. Now his shirt on the outside and Jack's shirt on the inside. And he's looking at this postcard. And in my interpretation, I was like, the first time I watched it, I was like, that's ridiculous. I don't know what that means. I mean, I was crying, but I was like, I don't understand the last line. What do you swear?
I swear what?
I'm kind of like, maybe that's him being like, I swear to honor your presence in my life by being myself, which we don't see because the movie ends. And I don't know. I think from my interpretation, I'm like, I feel like it implies some kind of commitment to living a more honest life. Or, I mean, I don't know, but it could mean so many things. And I like a little ambiguity in the end of a movie. Like,
absolutely.
It could be, I swear I won't forget you. I swear I'll always love you. Ah, emotion. That's overwhelming. What do you think it means?
What I got was, obviously, I swear, you know, I think it implies Jack as well. But I think it implies his daughter. And so when her daughter comes over, she comes over and says, I wish you were in my wedding because she's getting married. Mm. And Ennis initially denies it. And then after a couple seconds, he changes his mind, pops the champagne and says, you know what? Let me get somebody else to work that day.
Yeah.
And so that
choosing to remove himself from the isolation that he has conditioned himself to.
And so I think that was just one of the most biggest mistakes he made, is that isolation that he chooses to be, and he didn't realize how much hurt it was doing to others around him. And that because he was hurting so much, it's almost like that pain was blinding him from the people around him. And I think that I swear I won't make that same mistake again to my daughter, at least, because he was with his daughter, and that I'll try to be more present with the people around me and give the love that they deserve and the love that I want to give. And so it's almost like him learning from the relationship that he had with Jack, and to appreciate, you know, to just act right away and be in the present, because, you know, we never know when we're going to lose someone. And I think that this was kind of a way for him to redeem the mistake that he made, and to not do that again to, you know, his future generation, which is his daughter. So that's kind of what I interpreted, you know, swearing that he'll continue on to give love and not be so isolating because it's not doing him any good. You know, it, like you said, you know, it ended, you know, heteronormativity didn't serve him well.
No.
You know, it ended up with more pain, more loss. And
trying to perform something that he was not.
And I think that's very interesting, because the entire movie we see that homosexuality as something that would give that sort of result.
Mm.
And now we can see that it's not the case.
Yeah.
You know, I think it can create more pain and more suffering with, you know, being somebody that you're not.
Yeah.
And to conclude,
be yourself, guys.
Yeah, please. I think that's one of the main messages, is that the main messages I got is definitely be yourself. And you can never fight the heart's desire.
Yeah.
I think that was kind of what I got. And maybe a line or two, do you want to say what you kind of learned and what you got from the film?
I mean, the title of my paper was like, there was a colon. like Brokeback Mountain, like embodying queer resistance as a form of survival. Like, I think them, again, kind of this message of like choosing to be yourself and being your true self, being worth more than the hate that you will endure, like, or whatever consequence it will kind of elicit. Like, I think that is probably what hits home hardest. But also just like, I love this film as evidence of the fact that like queer love is real and valid and just as like rich and tender and real and emotional as heterosexual love. But yeah, I mean, I also like, what did I get from it? A lot of crying, a lot of tears, a lot of like me reckoning with like, and being grateful for the conditions of the world that I live in right now. But also an appreciation for melodrama, and also an appreciation for like this kind of storytelling in which obviously the landscape is like super important and the environment is very important, but it's such a character driven story. And I think honestly, that's why it sticks with us so well, because the characters are so rich, and that is really what makes it interesting and makes it compelling, is the dynamics between them and the love between them and the way that they interact with one another. God, I could just talk about this movie for hours. Like that,
no,
yeah.
Me
I mean,
too.
Because on the one hand, it's like it's so beautiful in the storytelling, and then it's also so beautiful, like, which I feel like we didn't even really get into too much, but like the technical aspects of it, and like the cinematography, and like, oh my God, the sound is amazing. The sound in this film is honestly, that's probably one of my favorite parts of it too. Is like the sound design and the way that like there's all these like natural sounds, mm-hmm. and a lot of the time like. There's one really beautiful, like, it's like a fight scene that Jack and Ennis are having, and it's completely silent besides their voices, and then, like, the sound of the gravel under their boots and the stream nearby.
Yeah.
And it's all, and then there's scenes with wind, and then there's scenes with fireworks, and it's all very, I don't know, it's all very naturalistic. That was a rambly answer. I love it for a lot of reasons, but I think it'll survive the test of time. I think this one will be a classic. I think in 50 years, people will still be watching this movie. Yeah,
I think so too, and I think I have to go rewatch it again to actually appreciate some more aspects of it, because it's a pretty dense movie. I think it because you know, this does have a timeline, which I really appreciated. I love it when movies incorporate different stages of people's lives, and so we get to experience it all together of who they are and as they develop. And so I think that was something I really, really appreciated with the movie. Mm-hmm. But
and the aesthetics of the time periods that it happens to be set in, like.
Mm-hmm.
Like the mustaches we see, the boots, the
mustache is my favorite.
Yeah. No, like the 60s, 70s, 80s. At the 80s by the end, I'm like, oh, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I love those periods in time anyway. So I was just like, wow, it's a period piece. It's a Western period piece.
I love it. But like you said, I could go hours and hours, but it seems like we are out of time. Thank you so much, Georgia, for coming on.
Thank you for having me. Everyone, please go watch this movie.
Yep.
Go
thank
watch
you.
It. Log it on Letterboxd.
All right. And if you guys are more interested in films, Georgia does do a show called Film Picnic every other Fridays at 10 a.m.
Yeah.
So please go ahead and tune in. That's it for today's episode. I hope you guys all have a wonderful rest of the week, and I'll see you guys next week. Bye-bye, everyone.
This is Bod. and you are listening to, hopefully, my music on UBC Radio CITR FM. That's 101.9.